say, Tom, that as far as the company is concerned, it's not going to be losing anything on the deal because you're going to charge the extra premium. You're saying that maybe you're a little concerned that maybe consumers won't want to pay the extra $3 or whatever it is, and some of them, therefore, will go uninsured.
Well, Senator Fry, what I'm concerned about, I guess, in the final analysis is you have been sitting through the liability crisis for 15 months. I sat with you on the other side listening, people complaining about the high cost of insurance. They were basically talking about commercial liability insurance at that time. You'll be hearing the same type of conversation when we mandate additional coverages on the automobile coverage, because they're going to be complaining not about availability but affordability. And we're going to, the insurance industry will be receiving the brunt of that conversation because of mandated coverages by the legislature. And so we see, one, we realize that maybe we're wearing black hats today. And if we raise our insurance premiums because of mandated coverages, our hats are going to get blacker all the time because of the public won't understand that it's mandated by the legislature.
Well, of course, I'll tell you, I don't know about Senator Brockman, but I get more contacts from constituents about trying to do something to really make insurance mandatory in Oregon instead of just having a statute that says you have to have it. They keep asking me, can't you do something to ensure that these people are, you know, carry insurance? And, well, we know that we can't do that. But it seems to me that the same underlying philosophy that gives us our mandatory insurance coverage law in Oregon would also justify mandatory uninsurance coverage in a certain amount. It seems like the same reasoning is there because we're hopefully requiring people to have some source to take care of their loss other than having to depend upon the welfare and the public. I guess that's a very important consideration.
Getting back to one other point, will the insurance companies lose money to start with? Yes, because all we have to have is one loss at $500,000, and it's going to take an awful lot of premium at $3 or $4 to pay for that. So the premiums will be jacked up over a period of time. But by the way, I might indicate to you that I made all the insurance lobby mad at me. I think it was 1977 because I helped Senator Walt Brown draft the mandatory insurance law for the state of Oregon. They've been moderating it and making it a toothless tiger ever since. So anyway, now the last page, the arbitration. I wonder if maybe this isn't an illegal delegation of authority for the legislature to allow some other body like this to set the laws or the judicial process here in the state of Oregon. I know that it's my understanding from talking to two defense attorneys that the American Arbitration Association uses one moderator or one arbiter, and most of them in Oregon under our current system uses three. All the expense except the first $100 is paid by the insurance company. We feel that it's much better to allow if there is some problems with the laws of arbitration in the state of Oregon, to allow the judicial process here in Oregon to modify those than to delegate it to some other bureaucratic organization that's not housed in the state of Oregon.
Okay.
It's also slow and very expensive through the American Arbitration Association.
Well, I agree on that. I agree on that. I've been both an arbiter under the rules and appointed by the AAA, and also I've had the AAA come in to arbitrate. But generally, it's been my practice as a general rule, the attorneys just agree, kind of go by the rule of the locale, and they get three lawyers together, and they very informally kind of work this thing out. So I think most arbitrations, it seems to me, don't follow any formal rules. But anyway, okay. Any questions, Senator Brockman?
No.
Okay,
thanks,
Tom. All right. Anyone else here on 756? Oh, okay, John, come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. Mr. Chairman, I have to admit that in trying to read this bill and understand it, anything that might be considered tissue, fluid, or gristle between my ears turned to stone and bone, because I have had real trouble understanding this. I have talked to lawyers about the provisions on the first page, and there seems to be quite a bit of confusion about this particular language. However, at the State Farm people did tell me that they felt that there was the possibility of drying up advance payments. And now after hearing this discussion, I can get back to them and I think fully confuse them. But I think we want to make sure that we're not doing something to dry up advance payments. I had one person that's been around insurance for a long time tell me 15 or 20 years ago, insurers were not making, it was very difficult to get an advance payment, which is very helpful to the insured. The second thing on the limits, I think you hit the point well in that it may well be good in requiring the insured to carry these, in some cases, very high limits of uninsured motors. At some point, I think it gets ridiculous if you're carrying the same limits as your BI limits. They're for a different purpose. You may well, as the case, my decision is based on the fact that I have very good health insurance coverage, and I choose to rely on that. I carry extra uninsured for the benefit of any guest passenger that I might have with me. But I surely do not want to carry, nor would I think all Oregonians want to carry, the same limit of uninsured motorist coverage that they have for bodily injury liability insurance.
You mean can you buy a policy that just where the uninsured motorist coverage just takes care of the passengers? And you can't buy a policy that says, look, we'll have 100, 300,000 for all the passengers and 5,100 for me.
Mr. Chairman, what I was saying is the only reason I carry additional uninsured motorist coverage is for the benefit of any passenger. That benefit would also accrue to myself and my family. But I do not rely upon that coverage to protect the health and welfare of my family should we be injured by an uninsured motorist. And I think the comments Mr. Bessonette made about the arbitration association are adequate. In fact, I'm not sure Oregon is represented in the configuration of the rules that are promulgated by that particular association. And so I think there is a question in the delegation of that authority by the state.
All right, thanks. Anybody else on 756? Close the public hearing on 756. House Bill 2191. I'll see who we got here. Dale, are you the only one on this? 2191. Are you here on that one?
Yes,
come on up. I guess you are the only one signed up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The amendments to the bill, the original bill, was totally changed by the amendments. And it's a very simple bill. This amends ORS 7.125, which is the statute which mandates the ability of the courts to destroy their district court records. Circuit court records cannot be destroyed for a period of 10 years. Under this statute, district court records may be destroyed as provided by rules promulgated by the Court of Appeals. It really comes down to a process between State Court Administrator's Office and the State Archivist. We worked with the State Court Administrator's Office in constructing the amendments which were passed by the House. The problem that developed here is that in drunk drive prosecutions, because of changes in the law, a drunk drive diversion is available to any person who has not been convicted of a drunk drive in the prior 10 years. Unfortunately, what was happening is, by this statute, district court records were being destroyed after 5 years, so that an individual who had a conviction 6 years ago for driving under the influence, he would come in and move by post-conviction relief to attack the original conviction, there would be no court records available for the state to prove this was a valid conviction. Consequently, the conviction would be overturned, and the diversion process would become a revolving door.
Okay, let me interject now. The records should show that the witness is Dale Penn, Marion County District Attorney, appearing on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, I assume.
Yes, okay. Mr. Chairman.
All right, go ahead.
Okay.
Where were you through?
So the problem was that prior convictions were being overturned in post-conviction because the records were just not available to defend the conviction itself. What this amended bill does is require that at the time when the court records or the tapes or the files would normally be destroyed, that they should be turned over to the county clerk to be retained, at least the records for drunk driving convictions, until 10 years had passed. The reason 10 years is utilized is because that's the period of time involved in the diversion statute. That's really the only relevant time period involved.
Where in the world are they going to keep all that stuff? A cassette tape for all these cases? You're going to have to build a wing on the courthouse, aren't you?
Well, that's why it was restricted only to drunk drives. It's difficult to, there is a storage problem, and that's why it was only restricted to drunk drives. It doesn't apply to other misdemeanors or other cases.
I wonder if it wouldn't be easier to, doesn't the uniform traffic citation have a spot on it, or couldn't a spot be put on it where it says whether the court advise a person of right to counsel and that kind of thing? I mean, couldn't we do that on the little piece of paper that doesn't take up so much room?
Except those, you see, though everything was being destroyed, citations, everything, and that was the problem. You would go back, and there would have been forms, just the one piece of paper that would show all of that, or a tape where a judge would have talked to the defendant, and everything was gone. It's very difficult to think, well, what would be necessary or what attack would be made on this conviction, and so you think forward and say this one little form will save you from any attack that could be made 5 years later. That's the difficulty that's presented.
How many DUII guilty pleas are ever challenged basis of voluntariness? I mean, out of 100, my guess would be maybe one.
Yeah. I can't say statewide. I know that in my office we were receiving 5 to 10 of these a month. And statewide, I know many other offices are receiving that type of attack. And it basically came down to someone who would go in and hire an attorney to attack because they were not eligible for diversion. That became a tactic.
All right, and then, and of course, how many of those? No, right now the tapes are kept for how long? 5 years.
5 years.
All right, out of the 5 or 10 that you say you were running into
per month.
Month. How many of those were beyond the 5 years?
We were losing almost every one of them because of this problem. I couldn't tell you precisely, but. Certainly, like 7 out of 10 of those was a situation where we could not go back and prove it.
No.
And maybe that's just because if it was a conviction last year, people aren't trying to go back and attack one that soon because it is so recent. I don't know.
Yeah. County clerks would have to say about all this. Yeah, it's just hard for me to visualize where they're going to stick all these things.
Mm-hmm. That's a problem, and yet that's the way the statutory scheme is set up, and we identify a 10-year period for diversion, and then we shoot ourselves in the foot and say we can't do it. We really only mean 5, and that's where we're at.
Let's reduce the 10 years to 5 years. That'd be another way of taking care of it?
Well, I suppose that is one way to deal with it.
Okay. Any questions, Senator Brockman?
No.
All right. Thanks, Dale.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 564. And we've got, find out how many witness sheets I've got.
Well,
I've got two of them so far.
Okay.
564, all right. Let's take a look here.
That's Wiz Wallace.
Oh, that's right. He, yeah. Okay. All right.
This time?
You betcha. All right. All right, Ken Barnes. We'll start with Ken Barnes. Senate Bill 564.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kendall Barnes. I'm the Assistant Chief Counsel in the Trial Division at the Department of Justice. One of our responsibilities in the Trial Division is defending tort actions brought against state agencies and state officers. We try to settle those cases when we can, and we try to take them to court and win them when we can't settle them. I'd like to point out one problem I think 564 presents, both as to our settlement possibilities and our litigation strategies. Under present law, when a plaintiff sues us for injuries sustained in an accident, the possibility sometimes surfaces that the plaintiff's current physical problems are related to or caused by prior injuries, not the current injury that we're being sued for. Under current law, we can investigate that possibility by, among other things, getting hospital records that relate to those prior injuries. What 564 would do is cut off our access to hospital records relating to those prior injuries. I tried to get as much data as I could for the committee on how often this problem comes up, but I'm afraid I don't have hard data. I've talked to the three attorneys in our office who've been there the longest and do the most of these types of cases, and our best estimate is maybe 15 to 20 times a year a serious question arises of whether we're being sued by a plaintiff for what he alleges are injuries caused by the current accident, and we have reason to think are injuries, in fact, related to prior accidents. I asked the lawyers what the experience is under the current law when we are able to investigate that by getting into those prior hospital records. And they tell me it breaks down roughly one-third, one-third, one-third. About a third of the time after seeing the hospital records, we are satisfied that our suspicions were unwarranted, that there is no basis for proceeding on the defense, that current claims are related to prior injuries, and frequently those cases promptly settle. About a third, we find that the prior hospital records document that in fact, we are being sued for a current claim that relates to prior injuries. Those often settle on terms favorable to us, or the plaintiffs abandon the case at that point. And about a third, it proves that the records are either inconclusive or debatable, and the matter proceeds to trial, but at least each side is equipped then to proceed to trial on what we will be fighting about. There may be reasons that don't occur to us to take away this option of investigating whether current claims are related to prior injuries or not, but they don't occur to us, and our reaction in summary, Mr. Chairman, is that it would reduce settlement possibilities by cutting off that line of investigation, and would reduce litigation options by cutting off having that access, having that information available to us before we actually hit the courtroom, and maybe taking it up at that time on a subpoena ducis tecum or something like that. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? All right. Now, let me... yes, counsel.
Mr. Barnes, under... if this became law, you would still be able to ask questions at deposition, would you not, prior injuries?
We usually do that before we would ever go looking for the hospital records, yes.
And I take it that under the proposed language, you would not feel that you would be able to go back to records of cases where you thought there was a direct involvement with a prior injury.
That's what we understand the intent of 564 to be.
The reason I ask, the person who suggested this problem to the Judiciary Committee is not able to be here today, and I don't want to suggest what his intent was, but he was trying to get at the situation that occurs where a defendant will simply blanket the hospitals in an area, pulling in all kinds of records for people, some of which are relevant to the case which has been filed, but some of which are not, and in many cases the plaintiff feels that there is a severe invasion of privacy. And I'm wondering if there is some way we can fix the language of this rule so that you folks are satisfied without having that invasion of privacy.
I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, that the present law protects the injured plaintiff in that situation. The present law says we can only go after hospital records within the scope of discovery under Rule 36B. 36B says we can only go after admissible evidence and matter that is reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. If a man is suing us for a back injury, I don't see how we could go after hospital records at a hospital that solely treated psychiatric conditions, for example. I don't think that would be within the scope of Rule 36B. We haven't done it. I haven't seen it done. But if we did it, if some cog slipped and we tried to do that, a plaintiff's lawyer who was on top of the situation would file a motion for a protective order, and he'd win. I think he'd win. I mean, if they're only talking about a upper back soft tissue injury and we want to find out what psychiatric treatment the plaintiff's received, he should win. So I do see there's a possible privacy problem, but I think the answer is in 36B, that this is not licensed to go after any medical treatment an injured plaintiff has ever received at any time in his or her life. It's licensed to go after something that has some nexus to the current lawsuit. We have to be able to convince the presiding judge in whatever county we're in that what we're after has some plausible nexus to the current litigation.
Would you have any objection to the amendment that's proposed on lines 14 and 15 that requires a copy of the complaint be sent along with the request to the hospital?
No objection.
Okay.
It would be a small additional paperwork burden, a small additional postage expense, and I doubt that most of the records people at the hospitals would have the vaguest idea what to do with it. Most of the time when we're dealing with hospital records people, it's a fairly low-level person we're dealing with. But
that was already the law.
That we send a copy, no, Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of any requirement we send a copy of the complaint with a copy of the request for production. And, of course, I thought the rationale for the amendment at lines 14 and 15 would be tied to the change at line 9. This would be the hospital's way of knowing whether what we were after was or was not tied to the current injury claim, and they would look at the current complaint to know what the current injury claim was.
I suppose the difficulty, though, is how do they know when they get a request from you or any other defense attorney, how do they know whether the whether their records are within the scope of discovery under Rule 36B. I mean, if all you send them is a request for their records, they have no way of knowing, so they're going to ship you their records.
Mr. Chairman, it doesn't work quite that rapidly. What happens is our request to the hospital has to be copied to the opposing counsel. So opposing counsel's aware that we're after those records as soon as the hospital is. No hospital is set up to respond faster than, maybe a couple weeks is optimum response time. And if the other side objects during that couple weeks, they will have filed their motion for protective order, instructed the hospital not to comply with our request pending order of the court.
Okay. Is there a sanction for parties, for defense attorneys who do not copy the plaintiff's attorney that you're aware of?
Assume the ultimate sanction of disbarment would be conceivable. In all candor, I can't imagine an attorney not copying opposing counsel with anything he's doing in a case. Certainly any discovery request.
You know, okay.
That appears to be one of the things that has led to this problem. And so then the issue is, okay, how do you get after that?
There is a change in Rule 55 that has been proposed by the Council on Court Procedures, which will take effect. And it comes about because of a practice I don't think most defense attorneys would countenance, but it happens enough that this rule was amended. What had been happening was that in some cases a defense attorney would send a law clerk with a subpoena over to the hospital, and under Rule 55, and I'm pretty sure it's Rule 55 anyway, and give the subpoena to the records librarian and sit there while the records librarian made, well, the subpoena would say, bring all your records over to my office because we're going to have a deposition on a certain date, and then the lawyer would say, well, you don't have to come over here to my office with all these records. If you just want to make us a copy and give them to my law clerk or mail them over to me, that'd be all right. And so this rule is going to correct that kind of a practice, because that could happen without any notice at all to the plaintiff. Now, maybe it's section E2 beginning on line 10. Let me see if I understand this, the way it works in practice. Now, you would want to get copies of some hospital records. So the way I read E2, you would have to tell your adversary that on a certain date, you were going to make a request to the hospital for certain records. And that then would give your adversary a chance to go into court and say, gee, you know, you shouldn't have those records. Is that right?
That's the way it works now, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. What would you think about adding to section E2 some words that the request for these records would have to state the basis of the request? That is, that you learned in a deposition that the person had a prior back injury 2 years before, or something that would kind of give an indication of that of the basis of your, that it could be discoverable, either was discoverable or could lead to discoverable evidence, so that at least there would be a burden on the person requesting all these hospital records to make some kind of a showing that they were related or could be related. I'm a little vague. I'm just trying to think in my own mind. This may not be the answer to the problem, this bill here. But the notice angle, I think, is, I don't think there would be any, from what you've said, I don't think that you would resist the idea that the adverse party should have notice of what you're up to, and for that matter, why you think you ought to have it. So if we just put that into the rule, maybe that would take care of some of these abuses out here.
It would take care of most of the concerns that I bring to you today, Mr. Chairman, with the possible exception that in a very small number of cases, our learning of the possibility of prior injuries that could be part and parcel of what we're now being sued for comes about through our own investigation. It's like investigator interviews with family or coworkers or something like that. That kind of material is generally protected under a work product privilege, and if it's more important to protect the plaintiff's privacy from just random snooping than to protect our work product privilege, so be it. But there would be some loss to us in having to disclose in all cases how we came to believe that there was a concrete possibility of current claims that really relate to prior injuries. It often also arises by consulting with Safe Corporation or the Workers' Comp Department to find out about prior workers' comp claims. Depending upon the antiquity of the claim, sometimes very little data is available to us. The plaintiff's now claiming your classic whiplash-type injury, which is a cervical or upper back injury, and all that the Workers' Comp Department or the Safe Corp can tell us is that there was an 8-year-old back claim. They can't find much more in their records about whether it's upper back or lower back or side back or whatever. So we don't often have an awful lot to go on, but we think that it's reasonable to allow us to ask now, as long as we're at least in the same general part of the anatomy and we're not trying to make the quantum leap from back to psychiatric treatment that I referred to a second ago.
I certainly understand why prior injuries might have relevancy to the current claim. I fully appreciate that. I'm thinking of, you know, let me put this example to the committee members here. A person is, all right, let's take the cervical strain case. Spending a lot of time giving advice on how to fill out forms and how to do this, that, and the other thing. And that's one reason we're putting all these forms in the code, I guess, so that people don't have to ask lawyers anymore. They just read the code, and then they go down and bother the clerk on how to fill it out.
Well, the garnishment forms have been in the statutes for a while, and it's because the legislature has wanted to make sure that the instructions are fairly standard in terms of what people do. We agree with you that clerks may be spending too much time doing that. Also, we don't really want the court to be the bottleneck between a creditor or an attorney being able to collect their money, because garnishments are a lot of paper to process.
Any questions, Mr. Swank, on this?
Also, I know that a lot of people, we just finished the amendments this morning, and a lot of people haven't had had time to look at them fully, as probably your counsel hasn't had time to.
Now, as I understand it, the creditor-debtor section of the Oregon State Bar has not yet taken a position on this bill. Is that right, Mr. Comstock?
We are opposed to the original form of the bill.
But you haven't had a chance to go through the amendments?
Correct.
All right. I got it. Okay. Thank you. Then, all right, Ira Zeroff.
Ira Zeroff, Oregon Legal Services. I'm masquerading at the moment as Richard Slotty, who could not be here. There is testimony in your file, I believe, from Mr. Slotty, and I'd like to raise the issues that he raised. And I've asked Mr. Comstock to return with me because he can answer the technical questions. I am not an expert on garnishment and will not be able to answer them, I'm certain. Mr. Slotty, who is a professor at Northwestern School of Law, he's an expert in consumer law. He works at the Lewis and Clark Legal Clinic. He has a number of concerns about this bill, which I would just like to outline very briefly. He is concerned that it will be impossible for garnishees to verify the kinds of costs that are necessary, I guess, in a garnishment, that they will not be able to make certain that the right amount of money has been taken from them because of the cost in the bill. The bill provides that the defendant can contest incorrect figures, but apparently judgment debtors, and I'm sure this is true, will not be able to verify those figures on their own. And as an attorney, I could not verify those figures on my own. I don't practice in that area and could not do it myself. Mr. Slotty believes that there's problems with the return of to the garnishee or the debtor of money that has been taken that is over the amount that should have been received. He feels that once the money goes into a trust fund of the attorney, there is a severe conflict of interest because the money is being garnished on one party's behalf and it has to be held for a certain amount of time because of the potential claim of the garnishee or debtor. He believes that there is a great problem with the ability to access records. Removal of the clerk from the garnishment process, as he said, eliminates the ability of the public or the judgment debtor to obtain access to records concerning the garnishment. Court files are public records. Attorneys' files are confidential. Should a garnishment occur in violation of the appropriate statutes, it would be difficult for the aggrieved judgment debtor to obtain access of the plaintiff's attorney's records of the garnishment. And he does not believe that the bill as it is written, he has not seen the amendments, obviously, safeguards the rights of the judgment debtor in that circumstance. He also believes that there is a conflict of interest with an attorney who must retain money received from the garnishee until the court determines the claim when there hasn't been an exemption claim made. The attorney must talk about the circumstances of how that money was received. At the same time, he's the person who's attempting to get the money from the source. So whether it's exempt or not, he will be involved in both aspects of that determination. And finally, he just believes that the passage of this kind of statute would increase the litigation in the courts. Say he is unable to be here. I believe Mr. Comstock can answer questions about the concerns that have been raised.
Questions? Okay, I don't have any questions. All right, thank you. Ron Summers, did you want to say something on this bill?
I certainly did.
Come on up.
Here's some material for the members of the committee. Mr. Chairman, I'm Ron Summers, an attorney from the Dalles. And while I cannot speak on behalf of the Committee of Procedure and Practice of the Bar, I am a member of that committee, and I am one of the three who was chosen as a subcommittee at our last meeting to look into this bill. And those of us who have looked into it are appalled. Now, the first thing I want to call to your attention is that this is a department bill. This isn't precipitated by the judges. And what you people forgot about is that a few years back, you unleashed a fungus on this state.
We didn't. We weren't even in this damn process.
Well, I understand that, but this body unleashed a fungus, and it's called a court consolidation. Now, just ask yourself a simple question, how we got to where we're at today. This state has operated, period, in excess of 100 years with the county clerks running this garnishment and the judgment record-keeping for this state with relatively few problems until the Judicial Department took it over. And those of you that read the paper remember the little scandal of them hanging on to money and being able to unaccount for it. That's why we're here today. The problems with this bill are just this simple, and I'll bring it down to your home level. I do some work occasionally for grain suppliers. Let's say, for example, PGG delivers $20,000 worth of merchandise to Senator Brockman's properties. And he pays them by a check, and the check inadvertently gets lost. Someone in the credit department calls up and says, Summers, do something. So I immediately go out and get a judgment just as he's ready to come down here. And the paper is delivered. Now we have a judgment, okay, for $20,000. If you read the slips correctly, you'll find out probably you got another $4,000 attorney fees added on there for the privilege of collecting it. So now there's a $24,000 lien against this property filed down in Deschutes County. He's just upset. He's paid for it, but that didn't get taken care of. So now he calls up and he says, Summers, look, on Friday, I've got a refinance scheduled of one of my apartment houses. I've got a piece of property that's ready to close. Or let's say I'm selling it on Friday. It's supposed to close. It's in the title company. And they just called up and said, this judgment's of record. Now, what's going on? I said, well, certainly you have a judgment. You want to get it off. So I said, the only way you're going to get it off, I don't know whether you paid it or not, send the money up to my office. So immediately he has somebody hand carry the money up to my office, and it gets deposited in the trust account. And I drop dead of a heart attack. Now where's his financial transaction? If he took the money over to the clerk's office, as is the law now, and it was deposited, the money is satisfied. That judgment's satisfied. So the record keeping which even by just glancing over this amendment is just impossible by what they've proposed here. You'll see by these comments of Paul Clayton, one of the members of the committee, there are a number of other issues to address very carefully. Basically, what this bill is designed to do is to remove work from the clerk's office. And I called Wally Carson and said, take a look at this. He didn't get a chance to, and he didn't even know it was going on. He didn't even know it was coming down here. And basically, what it is to remove work from the clerk's office. And I'll ask you this. Senator Brockman's been over there to his county courthouse. What they had three people in the clerk's office doing, you now have five people doing. What we had over in Baker, one person doing in the clerk's office, they now have three people doing. What two people did in the clerk's office in Wasco County, we now have five people doing. And what this body did when they created this is give Francis Henney in Hood River a $700 a month increase when she was very happy with her salary, doing more work than what's being done now. You ought to take a look at the whole system. But right now, what I'm asking is that we're going to meet on May 2nd. I realize that's a little far away for you, but that's the next first Saturday in May is when we meet. And we'd like to take this up, but I can't make any representation on behalf of our bar committee without a vote. But I'd ask you to look very carefully at it, what it is. And, Bill, you hit it right on the head when you said that all they have to do is spend $10 for a sign in the office, see? But what we're getting into is an area allowing attorneys to keep money in their trust account, an unaccountability of funds, and a disaster in the making, and less work for the clerk's office. Because now when you call up, as soon as this bill gets passed, if in fact it gets passed, it says, well, do it yourself. Go collect the money yourself. And there's never any accountability for the funds. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. But I just can't see how this would ever work.
What happened to my first check?
You'll have to sue to get it back. But in the meantime, yeah, your transaction just flew out the window, yeah, while I went down to here, see?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, these guys don't work at it, see? They're not used to doing this kind of stuff on a daily basis. And what's great theory to get a little work off our back? We don't want to answer questions. That's in their new summary. You know, you're paying their salary now, and you don't pay any attention to Davis Bacon, see? Down in Deschutes County, they're getting more than any legal secretary or what gets paid in the county court. But I'd ask you to take a very careful look at it and move very closely, because this isn't something that there was a human cry from the judges. This is something there's a human cry from the workers, this great fungus that's expanding here. And we don't want to do any more work, see? Thank you for your help.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Senate Bill 490. Let's see, wait a minute. Am I missing something here? No, not yet. 490. Paul Sundermeyer.
Chairman Fry, Senators, my name is Paul Sundermeyer. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Financial Fraud Section of the Department of Justice. In that capacity, I'm primarily responsible for the antitrust enforcement actions by the State Attorney General's Office. And I'm here in support of Senate Bill 490, which is a department bill. I have previously submitted some written testimony prior to the last hearing, so I will save you some of the history behind the reasons for needing this bill. Suffice it to say that its concerns an investigative demand, which is like a subpoena. It's issued by the Attorney General's office prior to filing a complaint for violations of or potential violations of the antitrust laws. It's meant to give us an opportunity to investigate a complaint before we get into spending the state's money on a case. Over the last many years, there's been a change in the antitrust law, which has put more of a burden, we believe, on the State Attorney General's offices to take charge of antitrust enforcement. This bill is meant to rectify what I think were some oversights when the antitrust
investigative demand statute was originally passed. Primarily, it does three things. It allows the Attorney General's office to use the investigation materials received under the investigative demand during the course of the investigation. As it now stands, you can only use it if you're talking to the person who gave it to you, and then later on if you actually file a case. The second thing it does is it allows us to use the information jointly with other law enforcement officials responsible for the antitrust laws. For instance, we might have a situation where the state of Washington and the state of Oregon are both representing the citizens as victims of an antitrust violation. It might be appropriate for us to coordinate our investigation, and we would like to be able to share that with Washington, and vice versa, hopefully. There's a provision in there to make Washington responsible for the same confidentiality standards that we ask for in the third provision, which is that it not be disclosed to other than the characterizations we have in the bill, and that ultimately at the end, whether there's a case or just the investigation ends, it's returned to the businessman when he asks for it. I think it's a pretty simple, straightforward bill. I think it's a very small area, but it's something that we really need. I'm available for questions.
Okay. What the section of the state bar is, there's not an antitrust section, is there, in the state bar?
Yes, there is.
Is there,
Chairman.
Is it called antitrust section?
There is an antitrust section, yes. I think it used to be antitrust and trade regulation. I'm not sure if that's still the actual name of it or not.
I guess I just wondered if there's any viewpoint from that section on this change. I don't see any problem with it myself, but I don't know. Any questions? Senator Brockman.
Is there a requirement or a request or whatever it might be that the federal government share their stuff at the local level as well? Or do they just come in and do it or make us do the homework or what?
Senator Brockman, Chairman Fry, if I could make that clear, Senator, you mean if the federal government is conducting an investigation,
mm-hmm.
then would they have to share their information with us?
Yeah.
Under their antitrust investigative demand statute, they do not have to currently. I might point out that the National Association of Attorneys General is in the process of promoting legislation in Congress now that would require them to share some information with us. Primarily in the area of mergers.
But this bill is, the way I understand it, asking our Attorney General to share it with anybody that might have some interest in it, whether others are reciprocal in that or not.
That's true. There might be occasions when it would be in our interest to get, say, the Federal Department of Justice interested in a case which has overtones that go beyond Oregon. And if we were able to show them that there was some meat to a case, it might be in our best interest and the interest of the state of Oregon to have them get that information. That's true. It's not necessarily limited to reciprocal situations, though.
Counsel.
Mr. Sundermeyer, do you read the language of the bill as requiring the Attorney General to share information, or do you read it as permissive?
It was meant to be permissive.
That's what I assumed.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
That will take care of the public hearing on Senate Bill 490. We'll go to public hearing on Senate Bill 518. Pam Ferrara.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Pam Ferrara, the Executive Director of Oregon Common Cause, and I believe you have my written testimony that I handed in about a week ago when this was last on the schedule. I'd like to just make a few brief remarks. What the bill does is a very simple idea. It gives the Oregon Government Ethics Commission the authority to hire its own attorney. In other words, an attorney separate from the Council of the Attorney General. We think there's a very simple reason why the Ethics Commission of all state agencies ought to be able to hire its own attorney. And that reason is there's a conflict of interest that exists between a partisan elected attorney general and the duty of the Ethics Commission. And the duty of the Ethics Commission, of course, as you know, is to oversee the conduct of public officials, both elected and appointed. The conflict of interest that we are the most concerned about is not the obvious one of having an ethics complaint brought against the Attorney General, because, as you know, the statute already provides for that sort of situation being taken care of. The subtle conflict is the one that we feel is the problem, and that is the deputy counsel who serves as the attorney, as the Ethics Commission's counsel from the Attorney General's office, possibly even unconsciously or subconsciously having the situation in the Attorney General's office in mind and giving advice to the Ethics Commission. The Ethics Commission is a unique state agency, and its uniqueness was pointed out, I think, in a rather dramatic fashion in a recent case. It was Davidson versus Safe. It was a civil case that the Ethics Commission brought against a Safe official. Their verdict in that case was appealed. The Court of Appeals, in upholding the verdict, stated that the Ethics Commission was a unique state agency in the sense that it was the only one that actually had the authority to interpret its own statutes. So I just kind of bring that to your attention to show you that, indeed, it is unique. And I know, because I've been, this is my third session now with this bill, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the history, that I'm sure that the Attorney General's, one of the Attorney General's objections has always been that, well, that will simply open the floodgates and all state agencies will want to have their own attorney. That may be the case, but we feel that the Ethics Commission really is unique and sits in a very special, very precarious, very important position in state government. And for that reason, it needs to have an attorney who is totally separate from any kind of partisan influence. Very briefly, the reason that this bill is here is that in the 1982 interim, there was a legislatively appointed task force that looked at all of the state government ethics laws. Out of that task force came a number of recommendations. I sat through all of the discussions of that task force, as did a number of our Common Cause board members, and through the discussions, the role of the Attorney General, as it had developed in the case against the former Senator Groner, was discussed. As a matter of fact, as I recall, that was part of the impetus for having the task force in the first place. As some of you may know, during the Groner case, the Attorney General actually at one point withdrew the deputy counsel from the Ethics Commission's employment, if you will, because the Attorney General was conducting a criminal investigation of former Senator Groner, and the Ethics Commission simultaneously was conducting a civil investigation. And they kind of fell out, tripped over each other, and just created a lot of problems. And so, and that is the one case that I know of where the Ethics Commission did indeed hire its own attorney at the request of the Attorney General. Anyway, philosophically, as the discussions during the task force developed, we became more and more convinced that it was important to make the Ethics Commission more independent. So as a result of that task force, a number of bills were drafted and introduced into the 83 session. I might also tell you that this concept in the 83 session actually passed both houses of the legislature, but was caught in a crossfire in a conference committee and died in the waning days of the session. Just one more brief comment, and that is, we don't feel that the funding of a private attorney would be a problem, because the Ethics Commission could look at its budget, use the fees that it currently pays to the Attorney General's deputy counsel, and possibly investigative fees as well, and fund it with their current budget allocation. So it would not, in other words, it would not involve any additional grant of monies to the Ethics Commission. I think I've said enough. I'd be happy to try and answer questions.
Any questions?
The way I read this, Mr. Chairman, is that it says that the Commission may. It doesn't say that they will.
It's permissive, yes.
Yeah. I want to make sure.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Jim Mountain.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Jim Mountain from the Department of Justice. I serve as special counsel to the Attorney General. The Attorney General opposes Senate Bill 518 for essentially three reasons. The problem, as you heard, that is attempted to be addressed is theoretical at best. As a practical matter, should a practical problem arise, there is a practical way to deal with that, and that is through current law, ORS Chapter 180-235, that allows the Attorney General to authorize an agency to hire private counsel where the Attorney General determines that in the public interest there may be a conflict of interest in his continuing representation. Third, the proposed solution to this non-problem is fraught with conflicts of a different nature, problems with the state being in a position of having taken conflicting legal positions. The problem is theoretical because we have not yet, as far in checking with the history of the department, had a claim of an actual conflict of interest in DOJ giving advice to the Ethics Commission. The commission members themselves and the executive director are themselves subject to this same ethics law, as is the Attorney General. And, ironically, any attorney hired by the commission as an agent of the commission would be subject to the requirements of the ethics code itself, would be, in that sense, in no different position than the Attorney General. The practical resolution, as I said, to these problems is in current law in ORS Chapter 180-235. Moreover, the Attorney General is on record before this body in saying that he would authorize the Ethics Commission to retain private counsel if presented with true conflict of interest situations. Yet, never again in the history have we been asked to provide private counsel because of a possible conflict. The problems with this proposed solution are very real. This bill, if adopted, would be a break from the policy that the states speak with one legal voice. For decades, it has been that policy has been expressed by this legislative body in the Department of Justice Act that consolidates state legal services in the Department of Justice. For decades, AGs of both parties have consistently pursued the policy that the state's the development of its legal policy should be consistent, and that is best served by consolidation of services.
I think that's kind of an overstatement. Decades, you know, it wasn't until Lee Johnson came along that there were more assistant attorneys general and there were private lawyers representing the state.
I say decades because, one, it has been, I hate to say, admit that it has been decades since Lee Johnson was attorney general. The other thing, too, is that the Department of Justice Act precedes the last recodification in 1954. If you want to go back as far as 1916, Mr. Chairman, you can find a case called Gibson versus Kay, where the Attorney General's office came in into the Supreme Court and opposed the Commerce Department's use of private counsel, opposed their billing of that. So that's why I say at least 60 years, 70 years. The problems with Senate Bill 518 is that it would allow essentially two law firms to potentially speak as to the state's legal policy pertaining to the Ethics Commission. We set up a potential for conflicts in the state's legal position. You would encourage opinion shopping by an agency.
Why don't we just The argument that this is going to open up the system to all the agencies wanting their own lawyers doesn't make too big an impression on me, but let's just stick to the Ethics Commission. How's that going to encourage or facilitate opinion shopping?
As the last point that was made, I think, by Senator Brockman's question of the previous witness was, well, this is permissive, isn't it? Yes, it is. So if you go to the Attorney General and you're the Ethics Commission and you kind of don't like that the advice that he's given, you might then go shopping for a private lawyer who might give you advice that you liked better. It could be anything from a question of public contracting law or to something that had to do with state legal policy regarding the ethics code itself. That's why I say there is the possibility for opinion shopping. And I'm not making an argument here today that this will open the floodgates to others. But what I'm saying is, even though the argument can be made that this is a unique group, it would be the one state agency that would have this type of power, the state one state executive agency. And they are not that unique, as I pointed out, where even their board, their executive director, and their private attorney would also be under the coverage of the ethics code. I am concerned, the department is concerned about any bill that opens up an agency to have a captive counsel, in a sense, their employee as their lawyer. That in itself is fraught with problems, particularly where we look to the government's lawyers to be thinking of state legal policy in general and not be just chasing one agency's agenda. And finally, the problem with two counsel is you set up the possible situation of a case in litigation entitled the State of Oregon versus the State of Oregon. That such a development would be a waste of judicial time, a waste of executive time, and a waste of the people's patience. In short, Senate Bill 518 is a solution in search of a problem. The solution that's proposed is fraught with more problems than would be resolved. This bill is not supported by the commission itself. The bill has died twice before. It should be interred for a third time.
No.
Okay, I have no further questions. Let's see, what time does that clock up there say, Scott? Yeah, I was going to give you 5 minutes, but Attorney General Frohnmayer took up three of the five, so you've got 2 minutes on the